Richard Elliott's Reel One.
Can you tell me about which unit of the army you were in and your rank when the Falklands War broke out, please?
Yes, I was in 3 Commando Brigade Air Squadron. I was in A flight. They split the squadron up into flights. And I was a staff sergeant, artificer, in charge of the maintenance of the aircraft and the vehicles. In A flight, 3 Commando Brigade.
And I think we should say that you were in the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers.
Yes, right.
Can you tell me how the news of the Falklands broke with you, please?
Well, that we're actually going to go to the Falklands.
Yes.
The unit.
That's right.
Yeah, we were actually on Spearhead at the time. Our flight, just our flight, not the whole squadron. And the flight commander called us in, a couple of us, and told us to prepare. That we're going on to Spearhead. They used to have a go down to days and an hour of standby, and they put us, if I remember right, on 24 hours standby. He told us what it was for, and that we had to prepare the flight, just the flight at the time, for deployment on board ship. But that was just a flight, it was not to be the whole squadron.
Did you have any inclination as to what it was?
Oh yes, he told us. But the problem we had, we were operating from a camp called Bickley, which was a marine camp up on Dartmoor, and people didn't like working up there, and we were on duty at the time, and we had to get another flight to take over without telling them the reason. And immediately they started getting suspicious. They knew that the Falklands incident was on. Of course, we couldn't tell anybody. They more or less quite rightly jumped to the conclusion, so we're obviously going to the Falklands, and there's a whole squadron gone. We have to say, well, we don't know anything about that. And the other thing I remember is also when we got back to the quarters with the wives to get our stuff together, they knew. They said, well, you've gone to the Falklands. So I don't know how the wives got to know about it. I remember that. But no, we couldn't say any more.
Can you tell me about your embarkation, please?
Yeah, we embarked at Plymouth, and I went on board the Drink. She was one of the LSLs. Alongside, behind Drake, was the Galahad. That's the only 2 ships I can remember, actually, at the berth where we were embarking. There was a frigate. I can't remember which frigate it was, came past at the time. But all this happened within, 8 to 10 hours. We were more or less getting loaded on board, and then we left. I also had to go up to Abingdon to get battle damage equipment. I just jumped in the Land Rover, so whilst the rest of the flight was deploying on board, I wasn't actually there. I was away getting what they call battle damage equipment from the Air Force, and that's it in Oxfordshire, so there was a good 8 hours to 10 hours past just trying to get that equipment. I also went to Middle Wallop, and they gave me everything they had there. So a lot of the deployment, whilst the flight was getting itself sorted out, I wasn't really involved with that. They just did that themselves. Me personally, I was getting that equipment.
What about your movie camera? Did you take a movie camera with you deliberately?
Yeah, I used to have one. I had it for years since I've been in the Far East in the early 70s. And I used to take it to Belize and that. Because it was a small, compact one, it would fit in an ammunition pouch. So I had a number of ammunition pouches, as we all did. But I had an extra one, which that camera fitted in. Unlike the video cameras of the early 80s were big and bulky, this was not, and quite robust. It had already been, I went to Nepal with it, been to the jungle, Belize, Singapore, I've been all over the world with it. And I just took it. I also got a lot of film as well. I took the risk and thought, crumbs, I'll take 20 or 30 rolls of film. I won't be able to get any of those film, and a number of batteries, and that's why. Any preparation I really did, I just threw them in the bottom and then thought no more of it until we actually got going.
What kind of camera was it?
It's a Canon 1014. I think it's a 1014. In fact, the museum's got it now. You'll have to check to see that. I mean, we've got the instruction manual here, but I think it's a Canon 1014.
So you'd had a fair amount of experience of using it?
Yeah, only as an amateur movie maker, shall we say, but I only did it for family. It was only for my own use, but over the years, we were in the Far East for 3 years, and I put the films together there. So I had used them before, yeah. And it's got a and a zoom on there. And I knew the basics, not to pan too quickly, but the thing is fairly straightforward anyway. For its time, it's quite an advanced camera.
What was the Army's attitude towards personnel using cameras?
No, there was nothing wrong with that. No. The only permission we needed when we came back, the only thing they were conscious of was there was no films of dead bodies and things like that after we got back. People who took stills never got them back. Kodak, apparently, a friend of mine, who was true or not, said his mother worked at Kodak, and a lot of those photography places were briefed, you know, to see what anything comes back like that, anything of sensitive nature, not to let release it. And the only people I know who had, shall we say, film like that, were the Army photographers, which I only know of one. Our own brigade had an ordnance photographer, and he did very well with his books and things afterwards, and he included some of the more nastier sides of the war. But if you think about what you saw, you didn't see a lot of the nastier side. And as I never had anything like that anywhere, well, I had a little bit of it, but my film was never under that censorship. But we had to have, I asked permission, because, of course, at the time, there was it was still a military operation, but it was clear, and people said, no, not when you had Hanrahan and that, taking what films he wanted, and they were quite annoyed with the BBC at the time with the way they just sent things back. No, there was no restriction on me. Obviously, there was, I couldn't send anything back anyway. I couldn't send the film back, and I wouldn't have done, you know, as we were going down there, so I kept it all with me. I never really asked permission, can I send this film back as I'm using it? I never did any of that. Everything stayed with me. And all our mail was obviously censored near the sensitive times, but there's nothing that film could have done anyway because it wasn't processed.
Was this Army attitude because of the possibility of the identification of dead individuals or because of the general attitude towards displaying?
I don't know. I mean, my own feelings were, even when our Major Cameron would brief, and the whole brief coming down from the top was, you know, I think they were trying to avoid a massive bloody conflict, you know, and I don't think it was in the interest of our nation, you know, the way we were portrayed abroad, to be seen to be, you know, to have war put onto our screens. And I suppose those in powers that be saw what happened to the Americans in Vietnam, and they didn't want the negative image. I don't know. There were others who probably cast the true light on that, but as I said, a friend of mine worked here, his mum worked at Kodak, I think it was in Stevenage, and she actually said, you know, we had to, anything like that which came back from that area, to report it. And I must admit, I never saw, I think, bodies laid out when the paratroopers were buried, and the only other nasty incident was in the Galahad, and that was when I got back, putting all my film together with all the film I can get hold of, as if there was no sort of horror to it all. There was plenty of dead people around, and there were, I think, and I remember seeing people with cameras. I remember seeing some of the special forces taking pictures after it was all over. And medical people were taking pictures as well, you know, standing there because there were bodies. And whatever happened to those films, I don't know. But I mean, not one way or another. You asked the question, but I never had anything like that.
So your ship was the Royal Fleet Auxiliary Geraint.
Geraint, yeah.
Geraint. Can you describe your voyage down, please?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to see the film and see the stills of an amphibious deployment, but the LSLs have the helicopters on the back. They carry three Gazelles on the back, and we can operate from one helicopter at a time with two with their blades folded. Picture paints a thousand words, but that was our operating area. We had areas where we could keep our stores, but we had no hangars, so they don't have hangars. And we worked a two-shift routine, if I remember right, on the way down there. It was quite relaxed. I mean, we were preparing, working up. Many of the pilots and the crew hadn't been to sea at all. I'd been to sea over my time. I'd been on LSLs. The ship itself had, I think, in excess of 260 personnel on board and full of equipment. She had the Rapier battery, which were King players when they actually got down there. We also have other elements of the workshop. We had a battery of guns, so we were well spread out, especially the regiment, the artillery. Obviously, if they lost a ship, they didn't want to lose everything, but we did have on board our ship the Rapier battery. If we'd lost that, we would have lost a vital element of our defence. We also had, later on, scientists from Farnborough the civil scientists on board who were all the way down there, and they developed satellite communications. They were quite interesting, some of those things, what they were doing, but you'd have to find out more about that from, I'd say Farnborough, it may have been Rardy, I'm not really sure, but the research, and they were not military, they were civil, they had equipment, which they were.
What kind of work did you personally do aboard ship on the way down?
Right, basically, myself, actually hands-on, very little, because there was two crews, there was two sergeants who were in charge of a crew of four men, engineers, as well as some handlers who would keep the aircraft clean and tidy, and they would alternate between the two of them. I'm there for, if everything went wrong, and they would need an engineering decision, it would be up to me to do that, authorise the aircraft to fly a little longer with something wrong with it, and just to make sure the whole of the operation worked correctly. I'd be responsible for all the serviceability of the aircraft to the flight commander. You know, I'd be the first person he would see when things were wrong. And when you're in a tight environment like that, yeah, it became apparent to me that there wasn't a lot for me to do initially. So what I did, I sorted the battle damage equipment out. I'd done a course, when I did my articles of training about 18 months before. We were the first to go through this specialised repair in the battlefield, you know, for aviation, and not just helicopters, fixed wing, to keep the things flying at all costs, sort of thing. And I had these special tools, which I told you earlier, I got from the Wallop at Abingdon, and I had to somehow put it together in a sensible package, which we could take ashore with us, because we were conscious we weren't going to have our vehicles with us. So I specialised on that. I also, the ship's engineer, realised, he said, well, look, we're going to be on ship, board ship for a long time. And if they'd never been at sea for so long without going into some form of hard dock for repair. And I think the Drake was due a layup for repair anyway, so she was at sea with lots of outstanding problems. And one of them was, for example, the air conditioning units didn't work properly. We never had enough water on board. And therefore, the engineers, which I was about, there was about six of us, we put our heads together and we shared these tasks. I helped fix the water evaporation equipment, because we, in the REMI, they train us to do more than just helicopters. You know, we're engineers, turn our hand to anything like that. Also, I was the only one on board with the welding equipment and was able to weld. And when we did the resupply at sea, I welded the water hose so we could fix that and get water on board. So it was more or less general engineering I turned my hand to rather than aviation, because these guys knew what they were doing, the two sergeants in charge of the flight. And the helicopters behaved quite well.
Did you stop at Ascension Island?
Yes, we did, yeah.
To do what?
There we had, there were rockets. Boscombe Down had developed a quick rocket pack, well, to fit onto the Gazelles. Sneb rockets, and one of the things we had to do was fit those. Another one was IFF fit, avionics, identity friend or foe. The idea being is that we would turn this electronics on, and the naval ships would not accidentally shoot us down. And then they never used it, because they decided whether it was, you know, we knew what putting we had, anything which didn't look like that, shoot it down. But to me at the time, the IFF seemed a good idea, and that had to be fitted. And also, it was for aviation a good time to get the helicopters ashore and just do any other training in support of marine training. The last stand before we actually finally put to sea for the final thing down to the Falklands. And also, it was to reorganise the ships. All cluttered on board, what they could get off they did, and rearrange the ships to be in a logistical order sort of thing. So they didn't have all their eggs in one basket. Except for they still had to put the refuse back on board our ship. They stayed.
Had you expected at this time that there would be fighting?
Yeah, there was a split. I mean, I couldn't see how either side could get out of it. A few years before, we'd been mobilised for Belize and went down to Belize, though that never actually materialised. But I had experienced mobilisation before, and you could tense the urgency and the traffic, and suddenly things happen so quickly, which they never happened before. You realise there's a political move. And of course, we can listen to the radio. And they had actually got their army well established on the Falkland Islands, and you know, I couldn't see no way out of that. But there were others who thought, no, we would be turned around. And let's face it, I think that was the majority opinion. Even before the first thing happened, which I suppose was a Sheffield, I thought now that we were going to go down there.
Any scares as you got into the South Atlantic?
Oh, well, they had submarine scares. And they had an overflying aircraft. I remember that. To be honest, I then found out that it was an Argentinian aircraft, but whether it was actually spying on us, but it was a civil aircraft. And I remember reading one of the books afterwards, one of Woodward's books, saying he almost had on his hands an incident like they had in Iran. And that was quite interesting, but I remember that. And also, this, we've spread out with submarine attacks, but they reckon a lot of these were whales. One thing we did when we were going down, we had lots of anybody who was in one area, Navy, Army, it didn't matter who you were, if you wanted to put a little letterette on just to keep us going, they would do that. And we had a submariner who explained submarines and what their limitations were. And then we jokingly, someone said, you know, they're chasing whales. It was apparently, it is difficult, a whale and a small submarine, to tell the difference. And though they probably were chasing whales, all the drills were carried out because it was real. Though it kind of sounds funny, I think, the anti-submarine people, there's not much they could have done.
What happened to you and the ship once you got into the actual war zone?
We were straight into San Carlos Bay. We were the first. As we were going in, they were landing in Fanning Head. You could hear the machine guns as they were carrying Fanning Head, and then our anchors went down, complete darkness. And then it dawned, we were preparing the helicopters then, and at dawn they took off and supported the various troops who were going ashore. They got as many as they could ashore in landing craft and helicopters, because technically it was an opposed landing, apart from, I believe there was a company or something like that on this place called Fanning Head. In fact, I think it was more than a company in the end, and it was those who shot down our helicopters, because we lost, a flight, the other flight were on Galahad, just a few hundred metres away, and sadly they lost two out of three of the helicopters within the first couple of hours.
How did your own work go at San Carlos?
Our own helicopters.
Your own personal work?
Well, the helicopters, our job really is to keep them flying. And we had about 99% serviceability. We were very fortunate throughout the whole of the campaign. All the flights were. I think, to be honest, we weren't fortunate. It's the way the aircraft, the Army maintains its aircraft. We may have a policy, I won't say over maintenance, but it paid off. And the aircraft were well clear for the operation, not just for San Carlos landings, but they carried on throughout the whole of the deployment. And even when we brought them back, I think about a quarter of them were still serviceable, even applying peacetime engineering standards, so that the equipment behaved very well. I mean, we had to repair and things like that, but not as bad as what we first thought. Bearing in mind a helicopter like the Gazelle isn't really an Army machine. Compared with the Scout helicopter we've had, you know, she's nothing to compare. She's quite delicate, and we thought we'd have problems, but we didn't.
When did you start filming?
Oh, from the very time we left Plymouth. I filmed them when Tristan came alongside. The captains wanted to practice lining themselves off for resupply at sea, and you see the men doing PE. We started to share, because the flight deck was open between the embarked troops, they'd taken turns to do PE, things like that on top. So now I filmed that on the way down, and then the helicopters filming our drills as the fellows practiced, because they could easily slip off the back if we weren't careful. And just generally filming as the work up, down to the central island and after. No, my film carries on all the way through. It's at the very end, where we were quite tired and, you know, it was all over. I had filmed, but I stopped filming then.
Was there anything in particular that you especially wanted to get on camera?
No.
What were the problems that you had in actually working the camera?
None. It worked perfectly. I never had any problems at all. It's never given me any problems, the camera. I think the big thing about it, because it is a mechanical as opposed to electronic, and at the time, in the early 80s, any electronics suffered from dampness, and of course we damp down there. And I think also, because it was kept in my bag, which is near to me, you know, my own equipment, the warmth. So wherever I went. It wasn't sort of allowed to get cold, allowed to get warm. So it never ever gave me any problems. As far as I know, it still works now.
What were the sights that you personally saw at the time of the landings that stick out in your memory?
Oh, right. It was just like an exercise. We've done it before, but on a bigger scale. But of course, the air raids were for real. Whereas before in Germany, places like that, you could just get the smell of the afterburns, and things like phantoms used to come over our positions in Germany just to sort of add realism to it. These people were firing, and you could hear, and the noise was terrific. And an air raid. I must admit, I've never seen anything of the Falklands yet. My film has no sound, and the sound's never been captured, because what people forget is it's not only their bombs going off, but there's every small arms on board all the ships firing, there's missiles being fired, there's people shouting and screaming, and the noise is pretty terrific. And a jet itself, isn't it? Even though on the air show, just one jet, but you have a couple of dozen coming in at various times, at various angles, that they make a lot of noise. Yeah, so the whole thing was noise. I always remember the noise more than anything else. And the other thing I remember was the divers. Well, there was always a threat of divers. Argentinian and throughout the days, as the days ticked by, they were still finding observation posts. The Argentinians didn't just jack and go. Their special forces came in. About, I think, on the third or fourth night, we fired at what we thought were sheep. And there was two dead Argentinian special forces creeping in. So they were getting through, and apparently, as I found out afterwards, they were bringing their aircraft spot on to the targets, which were us. And I do remember when we were on board the ship, because of things like fogmen, they put these surcharges in to the water. Now, we were on board the ship for quite a few days, whereas everybody went aboard ashore, because the LSLs were now no longer really required. They acted like hangars. And the place to come back for supply, and everything went ashore, so we were still there. And under the water line, you could be shaving or something like that, and suddenly a huge bang, and the ship shake, and you didn't know whether you'd blow up or it was surcharged. They never got used to that, because they couldn't tell you when it was going to go. They just do it at random, obviously, because if there's a beat, a rhythm to it, the divers would pick up that rhythm. And the idea is they stun the divers, but we never had anything like that. I remember that. And of course, when the raids are on, that's all very quick. That you mind your adrenaline's flowing. You're trying to find somewhere not to hide, but to sort of to get back and see what you're shooting at. We were fortunate on our ship because we were army and barked, and it was a fleet auxiliary. The captain never insisted, as long as we never got in the way of the actual what I'll call the action stations. There was damage control on all the ships, and of course the bridge was clear. And the guns up front, they put were clear. We could go anywhere. He didn't mind. Some of the ships, they enforced that everybody goes below, and the soldier didn't like that. No, and some, you know, that caused a lot of problems because they said, well, why? Why should we be down below? You know, if we're going to get hit, let's try and shoot them for a start. And then secondly, if anything goes wrong, we'll be on the top. We'll just swim ashore because we can see the side. So we never had that answer. Right? It was a very good ship to be on. The captain was brilliant. Everybody liked him. And it was very good. We had the best trip down. It was for the morale and everything compared with the other ships.
How long were you in San Carlos for?
What, in the
the landings?
So yeah, we went ashore. I can't remember. I think it was about 10 days, but I'd have to. Someone might say no, it was 2 weeks. Someone might say it was six. I think it was 10 days. But we were about 5 days, if I remember right, on board the ships. 4 to 5 days. About 4 to 5 days, maybe more. Going ashore. You see my film, you can see it. Obviously, it's done in an order. It's not my order. Oh, yeah, that's something. If you do explain that to them, if you try to put the tape to my film, it won't work. Because one moment there's helicopters on the ships, next moment they're off, next moment they're on. I just edited it to make it an interest rather than a follow me round, you see what I mean?
So you went ashore
pretty
quickly?
No. No, we persuaded the flight commander that it would be a good idea to stay on the ship. Of course, we never realised that was the biggest mistake of our lives, because everybody on shore was watching the ships getting hit. So, though the ships went, the Elk, which was a supply ship with ammunition, she came in and went and never stayed. Whereas the LSLs, Intrepid and Fearless, our escort ships always stayed in San Carlos Bay, and we were away at anchor. We never changed our position, so they knew more or less, I suspect, I don't know if that's the Argentinian pilots, but whichever way they come from, there wasn't much change other than the tidal and the wind changes of the ships, or our anchor positions. So where we were before is where we were again. And it's quite, you know, to watch they used to break the masts, the aerials of the ship, the pilots, as they were flying so low.
But eventually you did go ashore.
Yeah. I think it was about the fifth or sixth day. I cannot remember that. And we set up in Port San Carlos, I believe it was called. It was only a few houses, mind, but it had a jetty. And from there, we were up in a little valley there. Being light aviation, we could operate out. We had about, I think we had three tents. Our boxes, the helicopters were kept outside. Once we got a few trenches dug, and that's our position. And we maintained the helicopters throughout, and we went to Mount Kent like that. It's just a piece of equipment for the army. You know, they may look complex to the layman, but a lot of the equipment used by the army is complex. And we would move with our supporting commando unit, or wherever they sent us. And we stayed there for about 6 or 7 days, if I remember right. They broke out, and in the breakout, we then moved to Mount Kent, just at the base of Mount Kent, behind one of the gun batteries there. And we stayed there for a number of days, and then finally we moved into Stanley. In fact, if I remember right, it was one of our helicopters which took General Moore in for the surrender. So, I know when we got there, B flight was there, the scout flight, but it was that quick. As soon as the surrender, within hours, we moved over. And I remember we flew over where the Argentinian dead were all laid out from Pumas, where they'd planned, so I found out afterwards, to attack this gun battery, which we were just behind. But in coming round with their special troops to do this, I think it's Air Marines, they just asked, not accidentally, but unfortunately for them, we went right in front of the blowpipe detachment, we were moving location. And they realised these were Pumas, and they had some Augusta 109s, and one of them says, "That's not, we haven't got those." Pumas we did have, not now though, so that made them wary. Because I spoke to one of the guys afterwards, he said, as soon as they saw this other helicopter, which was not a Gazelle, they realised they were Argentinians, they took them all out, and of course killed a lot of them. And they were on the other side of the mountain when we went across into Stanley.
What were conditions like, physical living conditions ashore?
Well, they were bad for a lot. We were fortunate once again, you see, because of our tools and our bits, we do have to take a minimum amount. So we were able to take, I remember one of the lads got hold of a sack full of onions. Now I'm crazy now, but an onion with your compo made a difference. And we had, I think we had a four-man tent with about six of us in. Now, we had a tent. Now, not many people didn't have that. And we made up awnings at the site for that, our equipment. So we were reasonably tidy, whereas some others only had their trenches to live on and still maintained helicopters. So our flight was quite fortunate. We had that.
Were you confident about the outcome of the campaign?
No. Going back to our accommodation, we had tents and that, we were the spearhead. Remember I said at the beginning, we prepared. And we had that loading. And when they started restricting the equipment, that's when people had less. So I think it's only fair to the others to say, though in my film it shows tents and that, the other flights never had that. It's just we were fortunate because we'd loaded up on a flight. We weren't sure what it came to a head when they sank the Atlantic conveyor. We heard about that. And we heard that they were diverting 5 Brigade. Was it? I think it was 5 Brigade. Yes, 5 Brigade to South Georgia. And then there was one young fell on the flight. We'd already been briefed that they'd got a big airborne units, the Argentinians. And of course, we were prepared. And we still hadn't really left San Carlos Bay. Now, this is before Goose Green. So this was all. Was it after Goose Green? I can't remember at the time, but I do remember when the Atlantic. We knew the size of the Atlantic Conveyor. We knew how small our LSLs were. We knew how big those boats were. Because we'd seen the equivalent of the Atlantic Conveyor. I can't remember what the causeway, I think she was called. And she was bigger than Hermes, so to lose something like that with all the equipment on board, with Chinooks and heavy lift. And we thought, oh, I want.